I'm gonna go cut the show.
Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink with another installation of Christogenos, and we're going to be continuing our series on the book of Daniel. And we just want to recap a little bit here about Daniel chapter 8 before we go into Daniel chapter 9. I want to cover the possibility, and actually I should have asked you about this before the program today, Bill, but maybe if you could recap or at least think about it for a moment, your interpretation of the little horn being Muhammad?
Well, okay. Right, and I'm convinced of that.
Okay, you want to give people a rundown on that real quick before we progress with back to Daniel 8?
Well, if I can get to Daniel 8.
Okay, well, here, let me just read here the verses 9 through 13. And out of one of them, that is out of the four horns, the four sub-kingdoms that Alexander's kingdom broke up into, and out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Okay, and I recounted the traditional interpretation that this would be Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, and it waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the hosts and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. Now, I want to point out that this word sacrifice is added by the King James translators. We'll get into that a little bit later. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said to another, that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now, this is the main verse that the Seventh-day Adventists use to establish their 1844 date. They count from for the year 457 B.C., which they reckon to be the date of the beginning of Daniel's 70 weeks, okay? That's how they come up with the starting date of 457 B.C. Then they add 2,300 years to that date, and they come up with the date of 1844, okay?
Right, but this isn't really connected. You know, I see what you're saying, but this isn't really connected to
right, I'm just trying to give the listeners an idea of how the Seventh-day Adventists have come up with this significant date of 1844, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it is indeed significant, you know, in my opinion, the only way it can be significant, because their interpretation of this date was that it should have been the second coming of Jesus Christ, okay? And it turned out, of course, to be false. And every other anticipated date of the second coming has turned out to be false so far, okay? And many, many people have tried to pin that date down in previous historical times, but it has never panned out, and neither did it pan out in 1844. However, it seems to me that the fact that this great disappointment, that's what this year has become known as, the year of the great disappointment. What seems to me to be relevant about it is that just as the Israelites, a couple of hundred thousand Israelites were taken captive to Babylon in 586 B.C., only 42,000 returned, so that there was a culling process going on. Only the real faithful Israelites, true blue Israelites, would be the ones to keep their faith, and the rest of them stayed in Babylon, okay? Now, in 1844, we have something similar happening, namely the vast majority of people, Christians, who believed in this 1844 prophecy lost their faith.
Right, okay? But they were only a small portion of Christians.
Right, and they were only, there was also in this time period, the Enlightenment, a lot of the scientific worldview was taking over from the Christian, you know, biblical view.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but that had been transpiring for a couple of hundred years already.
No doubt, no doubt. And so that's the only thing I can relate it to, not that the second coming took place, but that this great disappointment took place. That's the only thing that really happened in 1844, okay? So it's actually the opposite of what the Seventh-day Adventists believe it to be, okay? You know, it's actually a culling process whereby, you know, a lot of Christians did, in fact, lose their faith over that false prediction, okay? Other than that, I can see no other, you know, no validity to the 1844 prophecy, okay? So now why don't you recap your interpretation here as this being a reference to Muhammad?
Well, I think that the daily sacrifice being taken away and he magnifying himself to the prince of the host.
Okay.
Okay. The host of heaven are the children of Israel.
Right. Okay.
Approximately a third, I mean, it's fair to say a third, of Christendom was destroyed in the Islamic conquests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. At the time, most of North Africa was white and Christian, especially in the West.
Okay.
And all of Syria and Mesopotamia were white and Christian, except for the Canaanites and the Jews,
mm-hmm.
And certain Arabic peoples.
Yeah.
But all of the white people were Christian, and the majority of the people were white.
Yes.
And the same thing is true with Anatolia, was white and Christian. And Islam wiped all that out. Spain was white and Christian, and Islam destroyed it. And that's a third of Christendom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, where some of the stars were thrown to the ground, the stars are very often indicative in prophecy of the children of Israel.
Right.
And that starts with the Song of Deborah,
mm-hmm.
where she says that the children of Israel fought as like the stars or something very similar to that in Judges chapter 5. Now, it's also true in the Revelation. So I see that being the fully indicative of Muhammad, and the daily being taken away does does intend a sacrifice, as the Septuagint translators translated the Hebrew word,
okay,
into the word thusia, which okay. only means a sacrifice.
Okay.
Okay. Now, to me, that is like saying that there would be a change of religion in terms that Daniel could understand.
Okay.
I don't take it to literally mean that the daily sacrifice was taken away.
Okay.
And that actually happened with Christ.
Right.
Right? But this character here created a major change in religion and magnified himself even to the prince of the host. The only historical figure we could find that in is Muhammad.
Okay.
Whose unholy Quran actually makes Jesus Christ secondary to a lower prophet and secondary to himself.
Okay.
In other words, in the Bible, yeah, to me, Yahshua Christ is Yahweh, is God. And in the Quran, there's God, and then there's Muhammad, and then there's, you know, a line of prophets, and Christ is one of them.
Yeah, Allah and Muhammad, right.
and they're actually, you know, I've read parts of the Quran, just enough to make me just want to barf and burn it.
Right, sure.
And it actually has contrived dialogues between Christ and the apostles.
Okay.
Which are very
yes.
parochial in their
yeah.
in their construction.
Like a third rate novel.
Well, yeah, right, like a third grade reader.
Yeah, okay.
And the characters who are supposed to be Christ and the apostles are saying, "Oh yes, Jesus, we are good Muslims."
Yes.
Yeah, you know, like lines like that. And I'm like, "What the heck is this?"
Yeah, right. Right.
This is just straight trash. Some Jew
yeah,
comic book author
yeah.
wrote this in the 6th century.
Okay, yeah. All right, very good. Okay. All right, but before we go on to Daniel chapter 9, I just want to bring up one more possible interpretation here. And that is, let me just scroll up and get the author's name real quick. It's not on the top of the page. Okay, well, in any case, let me...
I'm most comfortable with saying, you know, from my own opinion, the 2300 days, the prophecy is not yet manifest.
Okay, okay. So it's inconclusive, in your opinion, the 2300 days, okay?
Right, and my faith, you know, allows me that I don't have to beat my head against the wall to figure it out.
Right.
And contrive something from – yeah, you know, to me, I know everybody tries to make this point to Antiochus Epiphanes.
Right.
But to me, this prophecy the scope of the prophecy of Daniel isn't just around this 40,000, you know, people in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the host of heaven and the prince of the host, that's Yahshua Christ, and the host of heaven are all his people, and the pleasant land is basically Europe, because that's the land that his people dwell in.
Uh-huh, okay. All right, very good, very good. Now, I just want to make people aware of one other possible interpretation here, which I find very intriguing, and that's that this language is actually cosmological in nature. Okay, let me just quote from this website, www.sentex.net, Dan 2300, and there's more in there, but that's sentex.net. And this guy has a cosmological interpretation of the language here. Let me just quote here. Here's what the text of Daniel 8-10-12 says. The little horn of the male goat, the goat represents the Greek Empire, and the little horn represents Antiochus IV, king of Mesopotamia, Syria, and Palestine in the 2nd century B.C. This little horn extended itself towards the south, Egypt, towards the east, Mesopotamia, and towards the Holy Land, Jerusalem, and grew great and very tall, even growing to the height of the stars. He cast down to the ground the following, quote, stars, the host of heaven, the place of God's sanctuary, and the truth. Each of the above were said to be cast down and trampled by the little horn. Daniel's prophecy also says that the constant, Tamid, T-A-M-I-Y-D, translated daily, was taken away by the little horn. I suggest the term constant refers to the earth's diurnal rotation, the knowledge of which was suppressed. So rather than read the rest of this, what he simply is saying here is that Antiochus Epiphanes was responsible for changing the understanding in the Old Testament that Moses and the prophets and you know, obviously Adam, Seth, and Enoch understood that the earth was a planet and that they believed in outer space. And, of course, the book of Job says that the earth hangeth on nothing, that is, in empty space.
Well, the book of Job still says that, so Antiochus couldn't have changed it.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, but that he changed the conception of this from the biblical view to what he refers to as the Greco-Roman view, okay? That's his interpretation of this.
And I think he's just kidding himself because he makes no citations.
Yeah, well, I just quoted, you know, how he interprets the passage that we just have been working on.
Well, right, but I'm saying he's attributing a change in cosmological worldview to Antiochus Epiphanes.
Right.
Citations.
Right. Well, he's just using that starting date. And his end date is 1750 when the worldview, cosmological worldview we have today, he says that reoccurred. So in other words,
right, but the cosmological worldview that he attributes to Antiochus comes from it basically and he's not the founder of it,
right?
The leading philosophical figure of it is Aristotle.
Okay,
the flat Earth, you know, all the planet, you know, he
right, right.
It's his philosophy. You know, the ancient Greeks had a lot of stories,
mm-hmm.
and they only had stories. They talked about the vault of heaven, but
right.
they talked about the gods in chariots crossing the heavens.
Yeah,
and the planets to them were both orbs and gods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there are some philosophers like Plato talks about the wing. The wing. I'm going to quote Plato.
Okay,
the immortal and mortal creature. The wing is called. Is the corporeal element which is most akin to the divine, and which by nature tends to soar aloft and carry that which gravitates downwards into the upper region, which is the habitation of the gods.
Okay.
And he believed that the gods floated in the heavens.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
But there are Greek philosophers who believed that the heavens were a solid vault.
Right.
And they based this belief, basically there's older poems that reflect this belief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the story of Atlas holding the heavens up.
Okay.
Is one
right.
reflection of that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay? And there are descriptions in some of the historians that say that, you know, the planets travel on this, and the stars travel on this fixed firmament in heaven.
Yes.
You know, and let me the Homeric hymn from Hesiod, okay, which dates to the 7th century B.C., and it's the hymn to Ares, which, mm-hmm. who was the war god of the Greeks, okay?
Yeah.
And it says, I'll pick it up here, leader of righteous men, scepter king of manliness, who whirl your fiery spear among the planets in their sevenfold courses through the ether, which is the upper atmosphere,
yeah.
in the Greek cosmology, wherein your blazing steeds ever bear you above the third firmament of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that they pictured that heaven was solid,
yes.
that things could travel on it, and that it was layered.
Yeah, it was a sheet.
And that is the later Greek viewpoint, and that's Antiochus's viewpoint, but it doesn't start with Antiochus.
Right.
And Antiochus didn't change anything. It's just that the preponderant Greek philosophy was Aristotle, and that took root amongst the later Romish
right,
church
right.
bishops.
Okay, so what this author is saying from what I'm reading here is that Antiochus Epiphanes, when he attacked the temple in Jerusalem, he also changed the worldview, you know, that was...
Right, but I don't see that change is what
right,
I'm saying.
Right, right. But so what he does, he takes the date of the day that Antiochus Epiphanes did this, and then they sacrificed a pig on the altar, and then he adds 2,300 years to that, and he comes up with the date of 1750, okay?
And makes a story up about
right.
it.
Right. And
I don't find the guy has much credibility, I'm sorry.
But it's an interesting perspective, totally different from anything else I've read on the subject. And so,
well, to me, the lesson is that it shows the lengths that people go to try to figure out these prophecies.
Right. 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 But this is very interesting, and the fact is that the worldview that is given in the Old Testament clearly shows, because the Hebrew word rakia means expanse, it doesn't mean firmament, okay, that this idea of a firmament being a sheet or a screen in the sky, you know, behind which who knows what exists, and that the stars exist on this screen, that was, you know, that's a medieval worldview. You know, it's not a biblical worldview, and people have been crucified for holding a contrary view. You know, so there is credibility in his notion and the fact that this change in perspective did take place, but it's a stretch to, you know, have it start with Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so a very interesting perspective though, and that's again www.sentex.net where you can find this idea. Okay, so.
He makes a few grave errors. He tries to say that Epiphanes by itself means God the manifest.
Okay.
Or something like that. And I'm sorry, but that's just not true.
Okay.
Epiphanes doesn't have the word God in it.
Uh-huh.
It really means someone who stands out.
Okay.
Someone who's remarkable. Someone who is prolific, more or less.
Right, and all emperors think of themselves that way.
Well, of course.
Yes.
But
yes.
But it has no God in the title, in the uh-huh. word, so you can't put it in a definition.
Yes. Yes. Okay. All right, so I believe we ended at Daniel 8:27 last time?
Yeah, well, we should. If that's the last verse in Daniel, yes.
Right. Okay, so let's start with Daniel 9, verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. Okay, so we're talking about the 70 years prophecy, the 70 years captivity of the Judahites in Babylon. Verse 3. And I set my face to Yahweh Elohim to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed to Yahweh my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them that keep his commandments. Okay. So here we have a distinction between the concept of covenant and commandments. They're not the same, folks. There's a lot of people, especially evangelicals, who confuse these two. They're not the same. Verse 5, We have sinned and have committed iniquity and have done wickedly and have rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and from your judgments. Neither have we hearkened to your servants, the prophets, which spoke in your name to your kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us confusion of faces, as at this day to the men of Judah, and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and to all Israel, that are near and that are far off, through all the countries to which you have driven them, because of their trespass, that they have trespassed against you. Now, it's very interesting here, Bill, that Daniel 9:7 is confirming the fact that the Israelites are scattered all over the place here, okay? And we know from the book of Ezekiel, which is set in northern Mesopotamia, that's where the 10 northern tribes were scattered to. And, of course, Daniel is in Babylon. And
well, we've actually seen Daniel also in Susa. I mean, he's in Babylon during part of the writing of the book of Daniel.
Yeah.
But he was in Susa back in chapter 5, I think.
Okay.
And that's actually in northern Mesopotamia.
Yes, yes.
So Daniel's been all over the place. They don't, you know, we get this idea that they sit in one place in a room somewhere and write for 20 years. But no, that's not the case.
Yeah, and so these first seven verses confirm the fact that the Israelites have been dispersed, okay? And, of course, the mainstream churches do not want to know anything about the dispersed Israelites because they want to assume that the dispersed Israelites, if they acknowledge the fact at all, just disappeared into oblivion, never to be heard from again. Of course, the Bible contradicts that view, okay? Verse 8.
And both Daniel and Jeremiah continually mention the dispersed Israelites.
Right. Right, very good. Verse 8, O Lord, to us belongs confusion of face, to our kings, to our princes, and to our fathers, because we have sinned against you.
Now, I would connect that to the Susanna story in the Canaanites.
Okay.
The Canaanites.
Oh, right, the confusion of face, yes.
Yeah, you know, I would connect that right to the Canaanites that were posing as Judah.
Mm-hmm, okay.
That sin against them.
Right, right, okay.
You know, it might be taken metaphorically, but I don't know how you have confusion of face because you sleep with your neighbor's wife or steal or something. I mean, confusion of face comes through race mixing.
Right. Yeah, it could be metaphorical, but the first thing that occurs to me was race mixing, too. Yes. Verse 9, to the Lord our God belong mercies and forgivenesses, though we have rebelled against him. Neither have we obeyed the voice of Yahweh our Elohim to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants the prophets. Yea, all Israel have transgressed, that means all 12 tribes, your law, even by departing that they might not obey your voice. Therefore, the curse is poured out upon us, and the oath that is written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, because we have sinned against him. And, of course, we are still sinning against him today, folks. Verse 12, and he has confirmed his words which he spoke against us, and against our judges that judged us by bringing upon us a great evil. Now, of course, evil would be here punishment, okay? It's evil from our perspective. Yahweh does not do evil. For under the whole heaven has not been done as has been done upon Jerusalem, okay? So, yeah, Jerusalem had, in fact, worse is yet to come. Verse 13, as it is written in the law of Moses, all this evil has come upon us, yet made we not our prayer before Yahweh our Elohim, that we might turn from our iniquities and understand your truth. We are a rebellious lot, verse 14. Therefore has Yahweh watched upon the evil and brought it upon us, for Yahweh our God is righteous in all his works which he does, for we obeyed not his voice. So this confirms that the use of the word evil in verse 12 is metaphorical, okay? Yahweh does not do evil, because in verse 14 he confirms that everything Yahweh does is righteous and good. Verse 15, and now, O Yahweh our Elohim, that has brought your people forth out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand, and have gotten your renown as at this day, we have sinned, we have done wickedly. O Lord, according to you, according to all your righteousness, I beseech you, let your anger and your fury be turned away from your city, Jerusalem, your holy mountain, because of our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and your people are become a reproach to all that are about us, okay?
And I have a comment on verse 15.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, where Daniel says that Yahweh brought his people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand,
mm-hmm.
and hast gotten thee renown as at this day.
Okay.
And you know, when you read the Greek historian, when you read Strabo and Diodorus Siculus and several other Greek historians mention Moses.
Okay.
They know the story of the Exodus.
Ah, okay.
They don't doubt it. That they just take it for granted that Moses existed.
Right.
That the story of the Exodus was true.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they don't know the details.
Yeah.
And they that they understand that Moses was the lawgiver.
Yes. Yeah. And they don't doubt the miracles. They don't doubt any of it.
And these things are mentioned in many, many Greek historians and poets. I mean, like dozens. It's not just a couple.
Mm-hmm.
That these stories were well known. They were widespread.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when Daniel says that these, you know, taking Israel out of Egypt made God famous, which is basically what he's saying here,
uh-huh.
made Yahweh famous.
Right.
He means it because he's mentioned. I mean, if he's mentioned so often, if this story is mentioned so often in the books that we have left from antiquity,
yeah.
what was mentioned in the books of antiquity?
Right, right. Well, yeah, it's pretty obvious that all of the ancient world was familiar with the stories of the Israelites, and I think we can safely say that the Israelite writings were the most commonly understood and pre-existed before, obviously, the Greek writings and, you know, obviously the Roman writings, et cetera, okay? So the Israelite writings were by far the oldest, weren't they?
Absolutely,
yeah.
And Greek philosophers studied them.
Right, right.
It's very clear that Pythagoras and other Greek philosophers studied the Hebrew writings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, verse 17. Now therefore, O our God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications, and cause your face to shine upon your sanctuary that is desolate for Yahweh's sake. O my God, incline your ear and hear, open your eyes and behold our desolations, and the city which is called by your name, for we do not present our supplications before you for our righteousness, but for your great mercies. Now, isn't this very reminiscent of Paul's language, where he constantly tells the Israelites that we are not justified because of the law, because we weren't obeying the law.
Right.
We were justified merely because of his mercy.
Merely because of his mercy and his word to the fathers.
Yeah, and that's all Paul is saying. He's not saying the law ceased to exist. All he's saying is that we are not justified by the law because we weren't obeying it. Verse 18 is saying exactly the same thing. Verse 19, O Yahweh, hear, O Yahweh, forgive, O Lord, hearken and do, defer not for your own sake, O my Elohim, for your city and your people are called by your name. And while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before Yahweh my Elohim for the holy mountain of my God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. Okay, so there was an offering in the evening, and we're talking here. He calls Gabriel a man here, but aren't we talking about the angel, the familiar angel Gabriel?
Well, yes, I believe so, but by all appearances, they were men. I mean, they were just...
Okay, yeah, he appeared in the form of a man.
Them, yes,
yes,
glorified men, or it's restored. I mean, there's a lot of words you could use to try to describe this.
Sure.
But we don't have it in our experience.
Yes. Okay, verse 22. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give you skill and understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. 70 weeks, okay, here's the beginning of the 70 weeks prophecy, verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon your people, and we got to pay attention here because we're talking about Daniel's people, Israel. We're not, and specifically here, the house of Judah. We're talking here about the house of Judah. Okay? because the 10 northern tribes are off in Mesopotamia, northern Mesopotamia, and have nothing to do with this.
Well, I'd like to say also that most of Judah is with them, but...
Right, yeah, because Sennacherib...
This is the remnant of the house of Judah.
Right, this is the remnant of the house of Judah, but this experience, this prophecy concerns only the house of Judah, and not Ephraim, okay? And, you know, none of the other, you know, 10 tribes. This is only concerning the remnant, those 42,000 that came back from Babylon. That's only, this only people that this concerns, okay? So let me continue here, verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and the prophecy and to anoint the most holy. There's a lot going on here in verse 24, okay? So let's start with... to finish the transgression, okay? So what are we talking about here? Aren't we talking about...
the transgression is the state of divorce between Israel and Yahweh.
Okay.
That's the way I see it.
Okay.
And Yahshua finishes it because he's Yahweh and he dies.
Uh-huh.
And that releases Israel from the marriage.
Okay.
And satisfies the law of the husband.
Okay.
And Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 12.
Okay.
And that frees Israel, and it allows for a reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and I mean, it's a matter, it's an object of many other prophecies.
Yes.
That Yahweh would reconcile himself to Israel,
mm-hmm.
and Israel alone,
right.
in Christ.
Right.
And that's why it says in the next phrase, and to make reconciliation for iniquity.
Okay. Yeah, now to make an end of sins. Now, of course, sin did not end at 33 A.D. or on the day of the crucifixion. It did not end. It says to make an end of sin.
Well, I believe it. What it does is it puts the rest of the sins that were committed under the law that Israel was bound to,
mm-hmm.
by the first covenant.
Right. Right, makes an end of those sins, okay.
It makes it, you know, it's you have to look at it legally.
Yes,
rather
okay.
than look at it physically. People still continue to sin.
Right,
but this put an end to those sins. You know, where there's no law, there's no sin.
Right.
If the law is fulfilled, then those sins aren't accounted.
Yes, yes. So up until the time of the crucifixion, those sins were forgiven, and the next phrase, to make reconciliation for iniquity, the iniquity that occurred up to that point in time, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. Okay, now, obviously, we don't have the everlasting righteousness just yet. So to bring in is part of the process. It wasn't like the crucifixion suddenly created heaven on earth. It didn't. It just started the process. And of course, the destruction of the temple didn't take place until 37 years later. Okay.
So, well, right, but we could talk about this philosophically. I mean, everlasting righteousness belongs to those who are in Christ.
Right.
And if you're an Israelite and you're in Christ, because both of those are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be of the seed of Abraham and through Jacob and Isaac.
Right.
And then you have to be in Christ, meaning you have to be obedient to His will in the New Testament.
Right, right.
And to grasp that tree of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then everlasting righteousness belongs to you.
Right, right. Okay, and then to seal up the vision and the prophecy. And what do we mean here by seal up? Because, yeah, you know, obviously the vision and the prophecy that we're going to be discussing right here is what is under discussion. Okay? And so this particular prophecy is what we're about to, you know, uncover, unveil. And it seems like it's saying here, seal up. What do we mean by seal up?
Well, it might just mean to assure it.
Okay.
I mean, that word seal in the Greek, I'd have to study
right.
the Hebrew, but the Greek always often means to assure it or to
okay.
make it sure.
Ah, okay, yeah. So it's not like to cover it up, which is what, you know, a lot of people would think seal up means, because it means that in other verses, okay? And then to anoint the most holy, okay? Now, well, what's your take on anoint the most holy?
And this says the vision, the North American Bible says the vision and the prophecy ratified.
Ratified. Okay.
And that kind of goes with what I just said about the usual Greek word translated sealed means that it's a surety.
Right, right. So seal up, it's probably the word up, which sort of creates the confusion here. Okay.
Right, but the North American Bible says ratified.
Very good.
And that's probably, from just a general understanding of the way they use the language, I would say that that's probably more accurate.
Yes. Okay, very good. All right, verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem to Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. Okay, so we've got here now the verse 24 says 70 weeks. And here we have 62, which is 62. Now we only have 69 weeks that we're talking about here, with 1 week being left out here in verse 25. So let me read this again. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem to Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, the wall even in troublous times. So are we talking here to 69 weeks result in the day that Messiah was baptized?
Well, I hope to do a lengthy exposition of the history down to this point.
Okay.
And show when the building of the city commenced.
Okay.
And when it was effected and when it was finished. When the 69 weeks was ended.
Okay, well, let's do that now.
I believe that the 69, that he's baptized. You know, it says, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week.
Right.
And in the midst of the week, and that has to be the 70th week.
Okay, yes.
Okay, the 69 weeks are over, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week.
Yeah,
that's
many.
Clearly the 70th week.
Yes, that's in the 70th week, and no doubt about that, yeah. Okay, now most of the articles and summaries I've read on this subject pinpoint the decree of Artaxerxes in the year 458 B.C., okay? And so that if you count in 70 weeks will amount to 490 years, so that the resulting end of the 490 years is 33 A.D. You know, and there's dispute as to whether 458 or 457. You know, there's still a bit of dispute about that. But obviously, we're right in a ballpark whether it's 33 A.D. or 32 A.D.
I believe in the 32 AD crucifixion.
Okay.
And we're going to get into that. And that's
okay.
From Luke. And that can be almost assured from Luke 3:1.
Okay, so let's go into it.
I'd like to start back at the first week rather than start at the 70th.
Sure. Sure.
The first decrees were actually issued allowing these people to rebuild the city and the temple under Cyrus.
Okay.
In 538, 539, 539, in the first year of Cyrus.
Okay.
Okay, and these decrees were actually stalled off again and again.
Okay.
Okay. Cyrus died, and Cambyses received letters from the Cambyses was his successor. And he received letters from the people in the villages around the area of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And they were Canaanites and Samaritans and probably Edomites, and they were causing trouble for the people in Jerusalem.
Yes.
And they write Cambyses these letters, and he cancels the building of the temple. Okay?
Yes.
And this is testified by in 1 Esdras. The apocryphal, let me say that the apocryphal 1 Esdras is a much better book, version of the book of Ezra, than the book of Ezra is.
Okay.
Oh, okay. It has a whole chapter on the beginning that doesn't even appear in the book of Ezra, and it has a lot of historical citations within it that are much clearer or much more accurate than what we find in the book of Ezra.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the Jews took the book of Ezra and chopped it up and got Ezra out of it.
Right. Yeah.
That's my personal opinion.
No, I agree with you 100% because Ezra is so much shortened, and so is Daniel, apparently, that they like to chop out stuff. And the early church fathers repeatedly accused the Jews of taking out references to the Messiah. Okay? And so they would have done that in Ezra and Daniel and many other places as well. Okay.
Right. Well, well, the first decree was put out in 539, and
okay.
That was stalled, and Cyrus died, and Cambyses stalled it more, and we get all the way down to Darius, the Greek emperor Darius.
Okay.
And he finally said, okay, go ahead and rebuild the temple.
Okay.
And it was rebuilt in 516, and that fulfilled the 70 years of Jeremiah's prophecy that says that Jerusalem will lie desolate. For 70 years. But that has no connection to the 70 weeks prophecy
okay.
that we're about to cover.
Right.
You know, the 70 years prophecy runs from 586 B.C. in the destruction of Jerusalem to 516
mm-hmm.
when the temple is rebuilt.
Okay. Right. So now we're talking about the decree, the important decree that begins the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Okay. So The decree of Darius is not the one either, correct?
Well, no, that's not the one either.
Okay.
And actually, the decree of Darius allows them to rebuild the temple, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows them to rebuild the walls. And now I have to talk about Nehemiah.
Okay.
And all of the mainstream commentators date Nehemiah to 430-something B.C. after Esdras.
Mm-hmm.
After Ezra. And Ezra rebuilds the city. Well, let me tell you first that you don't build a city before you build the walls. Especially not in the Near East where robbers, Arab raiders are very common. Nobody builds a city before they build the walls. You build the walls first and then you build the city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And Nehemiah rebuilt the walls, but he never built the city. And Nehemiah rebuilt the walls not in 430 B.C., but in 490, from 502 to 490 B.C. is when the events of the book of Nehemiah took place. Okay?
Okay.
And Nehemiah actually references a lot of things that happened before the time of Ezra. But he mentions nothing that happened after the time of Ezra. And I have all sorts of proof that Nehemiah was the governor, because he's also called the Arthasasta, which is just a Persian word for governor, but it's also used of the chief governor or the emperor. It's a title.
Okay.
And the Greeks translated that Artaxerxes and applied it to only one emperor, but it represents a title applicable to any governor. And Nehemiah was the governor of Jerusalem for Darius the king from about 502 to about 490 B.C.,
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now the temple's rebuilt and Nehemiah builds the walls. And Nehemiah is recalled from Jerusalem in
okay.
490.
Okay.
And that's because that's the year that the Persians suffered a huge defeat to the Greeks at the Battle of Marathon.
Okay.
Now, when that happened, Darius made up his mind that they were going to invade Greece.
Yes.
All public works projects ended.
Yes. Okay.
In the Persian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the empire's resources went into assembling
yes.
a million-man army to invade
right.
Greece.
Yes. Okay.
Which Darius died. And his son, Xerxes, took over the job.
Yeah.
And built the army and invaded Greece and got his butt whooped.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
Right.
So when he suffered that defeat, there wasn't no. I mean, Persia was in mourning.
Yeah,
there was no. They weren't building cities.
Right. Right.
So we have the seventh year of Artaxerxes, according to Esdras, when finally Artaxerxes, long after the Persian War, 457 B.C., issues a decree to that Jerusalem, the city. May be rebuilt.
Okay.
But the walls were built by Nehemiah.
Okay.
between 502 and 490, and the temple was rebuilt by Zerubbabel in 516.
Okay. Okay. All right. So, but the this decree now is, as you're saying, issued in 457 B.C., which is, you know, that's the decree that we're taking.
I believe I have 458 for the issue of it.
Okay.
But it took Ezra 7 months to get to Jerusalem.
Okay. I see.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, what has to be discussed is the phrase, the going forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
And the Greek word is actually Exodus. Okay? And it's a going out, a marching out. And the Hebrew word is, I even hate to say it. It's matzah.
Matzah?
and it means, well, the bread's named after the Exodus.
I see, yes. Yeah.
You know the matzah bread?
Sure.
It's the Exodus bread.
Right.
That's
right.
What it means.
Okay.
Okay? It's a going forth, i.e. the act of egress,
mm-hmm,
or an exit, hence a source or a product.
Right.
And that's according to Strong's.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay?
Right,
now,
it can also be interpreted as the publication, you know.
Well, right, and
mm-hmm,
this is what I'm going to get at,
okay? Yes.
This first commandment was issued probably around 539 B.C. by Cyrus that the city may be rebuilt.
Yeah.
And I could demonstrate, and it's in 1 Esdras, the entire, you know, record of it, that he definitely intended the walls, the city, and the temple to be rebuilt right from that first commandment. But the circumstances delayed it for 70 or 80 years.
Right.
I mean, I didn't do them from 539 down to 457. That's a long time.
Yeah.
That's over 80 years that this was delayed.
Yes.
Because of extenuating circumstances, basically.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Well, the I read the going out as the end or close or the product of the command,
mm-hmm,
to build and restore the city.
Okay.
But which we have walls and a temple, but we really don't have a city,
right,
until Ezra returns in the seventh year of Artaxerxes and rebuilds the city.
Okay. And that's what it says in verse 20, to build Jerusalem.
Right.
To restore and build Jerusalem.
Right.
Yes.
And all we have is a wall. And there are apocryphal books that tell us that Nehemiah rebuilt the walls,
mm-hmm,
but Ezra rebuilds the city.
Yes.
Now, what if... Yeah, you know, it took them 7 months just to get to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know how long it took them to build the city.
Right.
It probably took many years,
yeah,
maybe 10 years, maybe 20. Who knows? I mean, you got to,
yeah,
build all these buildings and you know, houses and wells and water systems. And,
yeah,
and but, you know, they had aqueducts. They had a lot of things we don't even give them credit for to really restore a city. And,
mm-hmm,
and
yes,
if it took... I estimate it probably took at least a year or two just to get the job going.
You're right, sure.
And that
sure,
the product is not reached until the actual construction is underway.
Right.
So I don't have a problem with, and I'm going to say, and I have it in my notes, that I could arrive at 455 B.C. or thereabouts for the city to actually be built. In other words, we have a couple of year range here.
Okay.
And I know we differ over whether the crucifixion was in 31 or 32, but we,
yeah,
clearly have room for 483 years to be fulfilled right to the word of God.
Right.
But where we may not see it exactly, I definitely have it within 2 years.
Yeah.
That,
okay.
There's no doubt that
right,
the final fruit of the rebuilding of the city was, mm-hmm, was culminated between 457 and 455.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And you know, most of the interpreters put the baptism around 26 A.D. thereabouts. Okay. Maybe 25. Maybe 27. You know, like I said, there is still dispute about the exact dates. But you know, we're talking about the 70 years, and you know, but we can always count back from the actual date of crucifixion.
Right. And 408, you see, we can argue over the date of the crucifixion, but, you know, Luke says that Yahshua was basically baptized in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar.
Okay.
And that can only be 28 A.D.
28
okay?
A.D., okay.
That it began, the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar begins in August of 28 A.D.
Okay.
Okay, he took the throne in August of 14 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people try to play with the numbers and fudge the numbers by saying that, oh, he was associated on a throne a couple of years earlier or this or that, and it's all vanity because mm-hmm. he was actually named Caesar or successor to Augustus in like 4 AD, and you cannot have any other date because there's no other office for him.
Mm-hmm.
Once a Roman emperor named his successor, the entire empire understood that the named successor was basically second in command and would run the empire just like the emperor. And you know, he had all the power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Until, you know, except the formality that Augustus wasn't dead yet. But you remember, Augustus ruled Rome for like 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was in power a long, long time.
Right.
And you can't put any other office between 4 and 14 AD for Tiberius to assume any other power other than, you know, what he already had.
Right.
Until Augustus died, August of 14 AD, and his 15th year begins in August of 28 AD.
Okay.
So Yahshua Christ probably stood on his 30th birthday, which happened because he was born in 2 BC, according to my calculation.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, we could discuss that some other time.
Right.
But
people in the chat room are providing their own dates.
Oh, okay. But you can't, it's hard to argue with 28 AD, and that's when Yahshua was baptized.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, I figure his 30th birthday was probably on the Feast of Trumpets, whenever it fell that year, in late September, early October.
Yeah.
And that's just at the beginning of Tiberius's 15th year. And that would, if we want to believe that he had a 3.5-year ministry, because there's at least 3 Passovers mentioned during his ministry.
Okay.
The third one, of course, is the one that he is crucified on
in
the Gospel of John. And that's without doubt that there are 3 separate Passovers in the Gospel of John are actually mentioned by name, and there's other feasts, and there's another feast that myself and others believe to be a Passover, but it can't be proven. But that puts, you know, that leaves no doubt that his ministry wasn't 2.5 years long,
right.
And it was probably 3.5 years long. And if it was indeed 3.5 years long, then the ministry, the crucifixion, was in the spring of 32 A.D.,
okay.
Now, it's possible that there were, you know, that John mentioned all the Passovers by name and they're the only Passovers there were, that the crucifixion was in the spring of 31 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
But that would only make for the midst of the week being 2.5 years into the week, that doesn't challenge my faith either, but it's got to be one or the other.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and most people say his ministry was 3.5 years, not 2.5 years.
Right, and that would insist on a 32 spring of 32 A.D. crucifixion.
Right. Okay.
Because I believe Luke is right. Mm-hmm. Luke was a very exacting. He had a much greater sense of history than the other gospel writers.
Okay. Now, what about the possibility that, because very often when one region takes over from another, they they count their regency not as when the old person left, but it actually they count like the co-regency year as year.
Well, then it would be the 25th year because you cannot have any other date for Tiberius except when he was named successor in 4 and when Augustus died in 14.
Okay.
There's no other milestone there. There's no other appointment that could be made in Roman law by Roman custom for Tiberius. He was named Caesar in 4 AD. That makes him the co-regent.
Yeah.
And that's 4 AD. So it's either his, you know, it would have to be his 25th year or his 15th. There's no other possibility.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the reason I'm laughing is because one of the people in chat room says, "No way, it's not possible. 32 AD is not possible." But we're going by the figures we have, and a lot of people want to make the year of crucifixion based on days of the week. You know that the Passover was not on a Saturday; it was a Friday or Thursday, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, right, but Fausto can go argue with Luke.
Yeah, it's
you know, because the baptism was in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar.
Yeah.
That's 28 AD.
Yeah, that's
period.
Complicating the issue as to what day of the week are we talking about, okay, as opposed to simply we're just talking about years. You know, what are the possible years based on the decree of Artaxerxes, okay, and the year of the baptism.
Right, right. Now, Fausto is saying that 13 plus 14 is 27. But if you count correctly, the way the Romans counted,
mm-hmm.
the first year begins in 14, okay? The 15th year begins in 28.
Okay.
Okay, so at the 14th anniversary, the 15th year begins. 14 years in one day is the beginning of the 15th year.
Okay.
It says in the 15 years, 15th year. It doesn't say after 15 years.
Okay. Right.
You have to count like they do, not like we do.
Okay. Okay. But if the co-regency factor does apply, then it would be 27. But you're arguing very firmly against that. Okay. All right. Very good. So, but we're definitely in the ballpark that, you know, and what we're arguing, basically, we're arguing against the Jewish position that there is the last 3.5 years are put off into the future, or that this whole last week is put off into the future.
Well, that's just ridiculous.
I know. I know. But here, let me finish.
We'll see as we read the rest of Daniel.
Right. Let me finish verse 25. The last verse or phrase of it says, "The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times." And the books of Ezra and Nehemiah document how troublous those were. In fact, the Israelites refused to accept the help of the Samaritans who were trying to horn their way in, and they would not allow them to because they weren't Israelites. Okay? The Israelites were very racist. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah prove this point. Okay? Verse 26. "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself." Of course, he was cut off for his people of Israel, okay? And the people of... Now,
let me say that after the 62 weeks, he's going to be cut
off.
That's
one point that says after.
Right. It doesn't mean on the immediate expiration of 62 weeks.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Any time after, basically.
Yeah, any time after. Sometime after the 69th week, but before the end of the 70th week,
right.
Messiah shall be cut off. That's what this is saying, okay? And let me just quote here an apologist for the Jews who has this all fouled up, Carl Franklin, Christian Biblical Church of God, talking about the 70 weeks prophecy. And here's what he has to say. "The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD and in the end time," and he's quoting here the verse we're discussing, 9:26, "and the people of the prince," I haven't gotten to that part of it yet, "and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined." As that, let me just read it from the King James here. Let me just read the whole of verse 26. "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people..." Oh, sorry. I turned the page too far. "And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and to the end of the war, desolations are determined." So now we're talking about at some point after the 69th week, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. Now, who are the people of the prince?
Well, the prince that shall come is Messiah the prince.
Okay. Right.
I mean, the subject hasn't changed.
No, it's still we're talking about
the
Messiah.
From the previous verse.
Yeah, we're still talking about the Messiah.
And they really try to stretch this to try to say that this means some other prince.
Right.
Yeah, you know, because they can't make the connection between Christ and the Romans.
Right.
And they really pollute this verse in all of their foul commentaries.
Yes,
but
right.
the subject does not change.
Right.
Okay, the prince who's coming is Messiah the prince.
Okay, well, here
and
I can...
The people of the prince are the Roman people.
Right, exactly, they're Roman people. The people of the prince... it could be the prince could be Rome, you know, but they're still Israelites. You know, that's the Roman soldiers were Israelites.
Well, what I'm saying is that this says the Messiah the prince.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it talks about Messiah the prince in verse 25.
Right.
And then it says, and the people of the prince that shall come. That's Messiah the prince.
Okay. Right. Okay. So in either case, it's the people of the prince are the Roman Israelites.
Well, right. Because they are, in effect,
yes,
the kinsmen avengers.
Exactly.
They're the blood avengers.
Right. Now, whether you want to say the prince in verse 26 is Messiah or Titus, okay, either way, the interpretation is that the people of the prince that shall come are Israelites, okay? There's no indication here that we're talking about some Antichrist, okay?
Well, no,
that's
absolutely
how they interpret
not.
This. They have to,
that's just crazy because...
Yes.
Yahshua Christ confirmed the covenant with many for 1 week. The
right.
Antichrist didn't do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yahshua Christ caused the sacrifice and the oblation to cease.
Yeah.
The Antichrist isn't doing that.
Right.
I mean...
Now, here's what this guy has to say about verse 26. And we're just discussing that. Daniel 9:26. The destruction of the temple in 70 AD was a foretype of its final destruction in the end time. Okay? So he's projecting... I guess a new temple must be built before it can be destroyed in the end time. Okay, this is what apparently he's saying. Now here's his justification. There is a major break at the end of verse 26 in the form of a pause at the word determined. Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, I see a period there.
well, yeah, but there was no. Yeah, you know, whether you look at Greek or Hebrew, there are no periods.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? This guy's just a clown.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous suggestion, absolutely ridiculous. And then he says that this pause shows a prophetic leap forward to the last week or last 7 years of the 70 weeks, which he projects into the future. Okay, now just because there's a period at the end of a sentence does not project something 2,000 years into the future. But
well, the Antichrist isn't confirming any covenant.
That's right.
It's just absolutely childish.
Right.
Everything they do here to put this... This was the work of a Jesuit priest named Ribera in like the 1300s.
Yeah.
You know, this is the Jews for Jesus type of theology that's coming out of the Catholic Church.
Right. Well, this guy is apparently an evangelical, but let me finish this, what he has to say about this.
Well, he's trained by the same people. His theology comes from the same place.
Right. Well, it says, now in Hebrew, this pause simply looks like our colon, okay? Like the colon, this Hebrew punctuation mark indicates a major break in thought. Now, wait a minute. What Hebrew punctuation mark? Is he referring to the Masoretic?
Well, they drew dots all over all the characters, but
that's
that don't make them real. That don't put them in Daniel's writing.
The original Hebrew had no punctuation marks.
No, I've seen a lot of Hebrew inscriptions. I've never seen a period or an exclamation point.
But he's obviously talking about the Masoretic text, to which the Jewish Masoretes added vowel points. To determine what vowel should be read when the Paleo Hebrew never suggested any such thing, okay? Thus, let me just conclude his thoughts here. Thus, the Hebrew text shows a second gap in the fulfillment of the 70 weeks prophecy. This second gap is an unknown period of time between the 62-week period and the last week or 7 years of the prophecy. So, based on punctuation inserted by the Jews, this guy projects the last week 2,000 years into the future. That's his justification. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. So, now, of course, we're talking about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, and nobody denies that the city of Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. Okay? Nobody denies that. But to create a second fictitious destruction 2,000 years later, You can't come up with that from this. These verses say no such thing. And verse 27, as you mentioned, let's read it. And he, who confirms the covenant? What covenant did the Antichrist confirm with anybody in 33 A.D. or 32 A.D.?
Well, maybe he's talking about one of those bankers' covenants.
Yeah, yeah. Who is he and what covenant? If
right,
this is a reference to the Antichrist, what covenant?
They really stretch the truth to bring this out.
Yeah.
And they basically deny Christ.
Yeah,
they
of course.
Deny his sacrifice.
That's the whole point.
And they yeah, as well as Jewish theology.
That's right. It's Jewish theology. Yeah. And he shall confirm the covenant with many. Now it says many folks, not all. Okay. Because why? He didn't come to redeem the whole world. He only came to redeem Israel. And even, you know, we have to include, of course, the dispersed Israelites, as well as the Judahites and the Benjaminites. Okay? That's who he came for. And that's what Paul goes to great lengths to explain to Peter and the other Judahites, that the dispersed Israelites were also redeemed, not just the returnees and their descendants, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the you know, Israel was to supply the dominion, and Judah was to supply the altar.
Right.
And Comparé wrote pretty well about that.
Okay.
And that's the meaning of, you know, in part of Isaiah chapter 6, where it talks about a cut-down terebinth tree. That's those verses are really butchered in the King James Version. Someday I should translate the Hebrew of those, because they're pretty profound and point to that.
Yeah.
That Judah is supplying a place for the altar.
Yeah.
That for the one sacrifice that really counts.
Right. Right.
And that this whole thing is about the reconciliation of Yahshua with Israel.
Yeah.
And the confirmation of the covenant that's spoken about in Jeremiah chapter 31.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Luce says we have another gap theory. Actually, this guy's proposing several gap theories.
their entire theology is basically developed as a cover for their own crimes.
Right.
Because
right.
if we want to believe, you know, John tells us in his epistles, those who deny the Christ, they are the Antichrist.
That's right.
And he tells us that many Antichrists have already been born.
That's right.
At his time, in the first century.
That's right. And the whole point of projecting this into the future is to pretend that the Antichrist has not yet come.
And right. And they could get away with all their murder and all their vile
right.
things that they do and destroy all the children of Israel when the children of Israel don't even know there's an enemy.
That's right. That's right. That's the whole reason for distorting Daniel 9:24 through 27. That's why.
And everything else they distort in the Bible.
Yeah. Oh,
but,
yeah.
But whenever a Jew joins something, it's only for one reason.
To
pollute it and
right.
to pervert it.
Right, right. So I can't see any justification for interpreting Prince in verse 26 as Antichrist.
No, that's crazy.
Where do you
the
come
Prince
up with
in 26 is the same Prince in 25. Messiah the Prince.
Yes.
The Prince who shall come. They're
right.
the same being. They're the same entity. The focus hasn't changed to anybody else. The subject
right.
of the statements has not
yeah.
changed.
So they have utterly changed the context, okay, and so that the Prince that shall come, they suddenly project 2,000 years into the future without any justification whatsoever. The Antichrist is not even suggested in these verses. Not even suggested. But this is how they interpret it. Okay? And then on top of it, they don't deal with the word confirm the covenant. They ignore that passage because they don't know, they can't squeeze that into their Antichrist interpretation. Because if we're talking about the Antichrist, we have to ask, who is he? And what covenant did the Antichrist make with people in 27 AD? And they ignore that, which is proof that they, you know, they're just making this stuff up. You know, otherwise they wouldn't ignore it. Okay? So let me read all of 27. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. Okay, now, here, obviously, we're talking about the cessation of the blood sacrifices and oblations performed by the Levitical priesthood. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Well, yes, and that was the purpose, that the law would be fulfilled and there would be no need for sacrifice, and that's what Paul taught, and this is why he taught it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just amazing to me that, you know, here they project this into the future as well, presupposing that the third temple will have been built, okay, by the Jews in Jerusalem, and that must be destroyed too.
Well, let's think about it this way. If it's the Antichrist that's going to do away with the sacrifices, then why haven't we been doing the sacrifices for 2,000 years?
Yeah, right. But the Jews apparently have in secret. Okay, they still do the chicken thing.
They sacrifice the white Christian children.
That's right.
In secret.
That's right. That's absolutely right. They've been sacrificing Christians in the interim, haven't they? Yes. So, but the interpretation here is just so stretched and utterly ridiculous that anybody who teaches that the last 3.5 weeks or the last 7 weeks of this prophecy must be put off until 2,000 years later or whenever the judgment day is supposed to be, it's just absurd. I mean, they just pull a rabbit out of a hat. That's all they do. Okay. Let me, we're obviously talking here about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and that's the date on which the oblations and sacrifices did come to an abrupt halt.
Well, yeah, they had no choice but to discontinue them.
Exactly, because Titus destroyed the temple at that time. Okay, so let me finish verse 27. And he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. Okay, now what's this word consummation? They interpret this as to be the judgment day, okay, whereas what we're talking about really is the consummation of all the evil in 70 AD.
Right, it's the completion or termination, the full end,
complete
destruction.
Yeah, it doesn't say judgment day here, but that's how they interpret it, okay? And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate, okay? So what we're talking about is the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, and so that this can be projected no further into time than 70 AD, okay? Okay, guest 24 wants us to talk about Revelation 11:8. Okay, I don't know if you can turn your Bible, if you got your Bible handy. I was going to read the instruction or the speech that General Titus made.
Well, I don't turn my Bible. I just click another button.
Oh, okay.
And their bodies upon the streets of... He wants to talk about the two witnesses.
Oh, the two witnesses. Okay. Yeah, I don't see how that relates to...
I don't see how it relates to Daniel.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait until we cover the Revelation.
Right, yeah, we'll get to that in Revelation. But unless you have more to say about verse 27, I'd like to read the speech that Titus gave to the Jews. Because these, you know, at this time, I have to say that the Edomites had taken total control, the Herodians had taken total control of Judea by this time, okay? And these are what we call Jews. These are the people we know as Jews today. They're descended from these Edomites. They're not Judahites by any stretch of the imagination, okay? So any comments from you on the verse 27 before I read the speech of Titus?
Well, Joseph says that all of the noble people left the city of Jerusalem.
Okay.
In between the siege of I think his name was Cestius, the first siege and the siege of Titus.
Now, that word noble is the definition of the word Arian.
Well, in Greek, the word would probably be, I don't have the Greek to Josephus.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I only have Whiston's
translation.
Right, but
yeah, Arian means the noble ones, yes.
Actually, it's Aristos.
Aristos, okay.
Is the,
aristocratic.
Word. And it's the word we get aristocratic from, yes.
Yes, exactly. So all the noble people had left.
That's
by which
the common
he means,
word for noble.
By which he means Judahites, okay? Because he knows the difference between Herodian Edomites and Judahites, okay? It's very clear throughout his writings, okay? The translators try to muddy that up, okay? But when he's talking about the noble ones, he's not talking about Edomites. Okay?
Well, no, absolutely not. Yeah. Josephus goes to great lengths to describe the vile character and the disgusting things that they were doing at, you know, most of these people that were left in Jerusalem.
Yes, yes.
He really goes to great lengths to describe how bad they are. I mean, he doesn't make distinctions, really, between Edomites and Judahites.
Right.
But he does go to great lengths to describe how bad these people are.
Right, right. But he does differentiate between Herod as an Edomite.
Well, yes, he does do that. And and he talks about the Essenes having to be Judahites by birth.
Right.
But he doesn't, as a rule, I mean, Josephus sees many good qualities in Herod.
Okay.
he talked very well about Herod at times.
At times, right.
And okay. and he talked very well about other members of Herod's family at times.
Yeah.
He also talked about the horrible crimes they did.
Right.
But
right.
I don't really think that he attributed their crimes to their race.
Okay. Okay.
You know, I think that he was blind to that, like most, know, like today, we have 100 white women a day raped by niggers, and nobody will say that it's niggers doing it.
Right, right.
Nobody will just say that black men are going around raping 100 white women a day.
They won't even say that it's African-American.
Well, it's the same situation
right.
all over again.
Right. Okay.
It was a politically correct world then, and it's a sick politically correct world now.
Right, right. But here, to confirm the verdict of Josephus, this is the speech that Titus gave to the Jews, okay, before he destroyed them. I hope you, sirs, are now satiated with the miseries of your country, who have not had any just notions either of our great power or of your own great weakness, but have, like madmen, after a violent and inconsiderate manner, made such attempts as have brought your people, your city, and your holy house to destruction. You have been the men that have never left off rebelling since Pompey first conquered you, and have since that time made an open war with the Romans. Have you depended on your multitude, while a very small part of the Roman soldiery have been strong enough for you? Have you relied on the fidelity of your confederates? And what nations are there out of the limits of your dominion that would choose to assist the Jews before the Romans? Are your bodies stronger than ours? Nay, you know that the strong Germans themselves are our servants, have you stronger walls than we have? Pray, what greater obstacle is there than the wall of the ocean with which the Britons are encompassed and yet do adore the arms of the Romans? Do you exceed us in courage of soul and in the sagacity of your commanders? Nay, indeed, you cannot but know that the very Carthaginians have been conquered by us. It can therefore be nothing certainly but the kindness of us Romans, which hath excited you against us, who in the first place have given you this land to possess, and in the next place have set over you kings of your own nation, which a lot of kingdoms wouldn't do. It was very kind of the Romans to do that for people, okay? And in the third place have preserved the laws of your forefathers to you, and have withal permitted you to live either by yourselves or among others as it should please you. And what is our chief favor of all, we have given you leave to gather up that tribute, which is paid to God, with such other gifts that are dedicated to him, nor have we called those that carried those donations to account, nor prohibited them, till at length you become richer than we ourselves. He's definitely talking about Jews now. Even when you were our enemies, and you made preparations for war against us with our own money, nay, after all, when you were in the enjoyment of all...
Well, that sounds like something the Jews do.
Yeah.
They print out money for us and then they use it against us.
He's talking about Jews, not Israelites, there's no doubt. Nay, after all, when you were in the enjoyment of all these advantages, you turned your too great plenty against those that gave it to you, like merciless serpents have thrown out your poison against those that treated you kindly.
That just kind of nailed it right there, right?
Yeah. I mean, has he got these people nailed or what? You know, and basically what he's telling them is all of the advantages that Rome gave to the Jews in Judea, which they didn't give to any other nation, okay? And he's telling them, well, this is how you repay us with our, you know, our kindness to you. I mean, obviously we're talking about comparative kindness, you know, nobody wants to be occupied by a foreign country, you know. But he's saying to these Jews,
well,
that,
right. The point is that Rome was kind. Yeah, you know, Tacitus said that of one war the Romans had against the nation, that they created desolation and call it peace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, Rome had the power to just wipe out a civilian population.
That's right.
And letting them live with their own leaders is basically a kindness.
That's right. That's right. It's very kind of, for a conquering army to allow the population to live and preserve their own priests and leaders. You know, of course, they were tax collectors for the Romans too, you know. But, yeah, this is for compared with other military regimes who would have just come in and wiped everything out, this was indeed kindness, you know. And so Titus is telling these Jews, you know, why are you so thankless? You're absolutely thankless compared to other people. So let me continue here. I suppose, therefore, that you might despise the slothfulness of Nero, and like limbs of the body are broken or dislocated, you did then lie quiet, waiting for some other time, though still with malicious intention, and have now showed your distemper to be greater than ever, and have extended your desires as far as your impudent and immense hopes would enable you to do it. In other words, you people are just totally impotent in the face of our army, yet you expect to overthrow us, okay? At this time, my father came into this country, not with a design to punish you for what you had done under Cestius, but to admonish you. For had he come to overthrow your nation, he had run directly to your fountainhead and had immediately laid this city waste. Whereas he went and burnt Galilee and the neighboring parts and thereby gave you time for repentance, which instance of humanity you took for an argument of his weakness. Okay. Then did you Jews show yourselves to be our enemies. You sent embassies to those of your nation that are beyond Euphrates to assist you in your raising disturbances. Okay, again, proof that the Israelites, as Josephus told us, lived, the vast majority of the Israelites lived beyond Euphrates, at least beyond the limits of Judea. New walls were built by you around your city. Seditions arose, and one tyrant contended against another, and a civil war broke out among you, such indeed as became none but so wicked a people as you are. I then came to the city as unwillingly sent by my father and received melancholy injunctions from him. When I heard that the people were disposed to peace, I rejoiced at it. I exhorted you to leave off these proceedings before I began this war. I spared you even when you had fought, if you turn the page, against me a great while. I gave my right hand as security to the deserters. I observed what I had promised faithfully. When they fled to me, I had compassion on many of those that I had taken captive. I tortured those that were eager for war in order to restrain them. So he's telling these people that he did everything he could to prevent this war. But these Jews simply resisted every move. Finally, yet have you still despised every one of my proposals and have set fire to your holy house with your own hands. What cannot be healed shall be punished, and the rest I will preserve for my own use. At this, Titus had great indignation that when they were in the case of men already taken captives, they should pretend to make their own terms with him as if they had been conquerors. Okay.
Well, there is evidence in Josephus that Titus was actually very magnanimous, that he really tried to spare the temple.
Yes, he did.
He didn't want them to harm the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers went and tore it down behind his back looking for the gold.
Right.
And Yahweh wanted it torn down.
Yes, yes.
So even with Titus's magnanimity, it could not be prevented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it shows here that Titus has utter contempt for these Jews as being totally reprehensible people that you cannot make any agreements with because they break all their agreements. And what do we see with Jews today?
Yeah, well, the seed of Cain, they don't change.
Yeah.
Their behavior doesn't change.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, and I have a friend in this forum that'll say an apple tree grows apple seeds.
Yeah.
And that grows other apple tree. That's the way it works.
That's right.
They're not going to change.
That's right. That's right.
And all of that perfidy and treachery that they had in the first century, and the 20th century B.C., and the 30th century B.C.,
right,
and all through history, they still have it.
Yeah, yeah. Wherever our people have had to deal with the Jews, they have always been treacherous, totally treacherous. They have been deceitful, and they have murdered us time and time again. And this, so this, Titus is fulfilling. He is fulfilling Daniel 9:26, without a doubt. That's the fulfillment of Daniel 9:26. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and to the end of the war desolations are determined. And this is what Titus did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is all fulfilled, Daniel 9. Now, a lot of the, you know, like V.S. Harrell and a lot of those idiots, that they try to say that all prophecy was fulfilled by 70 A.D.
No.
and that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, not probably.
But all of Daniel 9 mm-hmm. was definitely fulfilled by 70 A.D.
Right, right, yeah. And there's all kinds of prophecy that relate to the judgment day. None of them, you know, 70 A.D. was not the judgment day.
Well, there's all kinds of prophecy that relate to all through history. Look at the Revelation.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the fall of Rome, the Islamic conquest, the Reformation. It's all in the Revelation.
Yeah, right, right.
And that's 1,000 years past 70 A.D.
That's right. That's
or
right.
Or 1,500 or whatever.
Yeah, and in fact, the Book of Revelation wasn't even written until 90 A.D. So
right.
all that.
Well, they can, you know, Harrell and those the preterists. They
yeah.
contend with that too.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they contend with the date of the Revelation being
uh-huh.
written.
But
and that's against all early testimony.
Right.
You
sure.
know, it's against all of the testimony of the early
yeah.
Christian fathers
yeah, and
that they dismiss all of that.
Yeah, and who's Mystery Babylon? Who's Mystery Babylon? You know,
well, absolutely. It's so clear that all of this is with us today.
Right.
And that prophecy still unfolds.
Yeah, preterism is just, you know, it's off the wall. I mean, they consider us to be off the wall.
Harrell is as bad as Ribera and his futurism.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, the preterists are as bad as the futurists.
Right, right. So, yeah, and then what are the last days? I mean, you know, we're in the last days right now. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, they would have to consider the days just before 70 AD as the last days. I mean, then when is the restoration of the kingdom? You know,
Harold's position is that we've had the restoration of the kingdom and we're supposed to take control of it now.
Oh, okay. So we've had the kingdom, we don't know it.
Yeah, right.
Okay. All right. Okay, yeah, well, you know, obviously what you just said about the Book of Revelation with all these prophecies having been future, all these prophecies, you know, the first, second, and third woes. All of these occurred after 70 A.D. There's no way to interpret those as having occurred before 70 A.D. You know, so that interpretation is just wrong. It's just plain wrong. Well, okay, that brings us to the end of Daniel chapter 9. I hope that we have demonstrated that this ridiculous notion that the last 7 weeks or the last 3.5 weeks are somehow postponed to the future is just Jewish nonsense designed to give the Jews an out, okay, that they did not crucify the Messiah and the Messiah was not, you know, it was the prince, the Antichrist, they say this is what these verses are talking about.
There's no doubt in my mind that the Jews have bought and paid for all of the doctrines of mainstream Christianity.
That's right.
And none of those doctrines are actually Christianity.
That's right. That's right. It's Judaism disguised as Christianity. Maybe this comes from the C.I. Schofield Reference Bible too. I don't know.
Well, he's a big proponent. But the futurism started with the Jesuits,
mm-hmm.
and it got into evangelism and Pentecostalism through the Scots and the English. They helped with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Clifton did a good expose on the Scottish. I believe it was a Scotsman that had translated Ribera's work
mm-hmm.
into English and brought it to America, and basically it's you know, all the false doctrines come from the same devil
mm-hmm.
or the same group of them,
right?
And there's no doubt there are lots of clear lines
yeah.
right from the Jews into the modern evangelical seminaries.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many people teach this nonsense that the Antichrist is yet to come. This is absolute nonsense. Yeah, the Bible refutes that in so many places. It's incredible, especially.
Well, it's just
John.
So clear, just in the little epistles of John.
Yes.
Even now, many Antichrists have already been born.
Mm-hmm.
And they're born. Antichrists are born.
Yeah.
They don't appear. They don't come down from heaven. They're born.
It's not just a spiritual entity, right? Right. Yes, yes, yes. Okay. All right. Well, I have to sign off because in half an hour I got a show with Rick Adams on the Republic Broadcasting Network. So I got to prepare for that and take a little break. So, but thank you, Bill, for helping me clarify that the mainstream interpretations of Daniel 9 are just plain balderdash, absolute rot, and no one should take it seriously. These verses are talking about the Messiah. Not about the Antichrist.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Praise Yahweh.
Okay. Praise Yahweh. Thanks for listening, everybody. And if you have time, please tune in half an hour on Republic Broadcasting Network. I will be on with Rick Adams, and we'll be talking about the pagan origins of Christmas and also the archaeological reality that verifies the Bible. Okay? That should be a lot of fun. Talk to you later. Yah bless, everybody.